Well, good morning. Calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. Welcome to everybody, members of the committee and members of the public. So we have, for those who are watching online, as always, I'm just going to point out that there are meeting materials on our committee website, which you can find at the House website. Hopefully, that should be you can use. Hopefully, should be fine to track that down. We do not have minutes again today. We have a little bit of issue putting those together, but we should be able to catch up on. I guess today is Tuesday, right? So not Thursday. I'm excited that we've had a series of hearings where we're helping families to meet some really basic needs. So a week ago, we passed funding for food shelves, make sure people can eat. Then on Thursday, several proposals relating to child care and early learning, again, really critical needs for kids and for families and for all of us. And then today, we will be addressing the issue of homelessness and people who do not have a stable place to live, which we know has a big impact on them. We're going to have couple presentations on that topic, and then we're going to have a very exciting bill get presented to us as well. So just want to see if there are any questions from anybody before we begin. Okay, not seeing anything at all. So, okay, we will get started then by calling up Kathy Tenbrook to speak. And I'm going to ask each of our testifiers, I'll be asking you to identify yourself, to share your preferred pronoun, if you're comfortable with that, pronouns, and then to proceed with your testimony. And so we will start with Kathy Tenbrook. And so please, you can follow that direction and then dive on in. And so glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Chair Pinto. Good morning, committee. I'm very delighted to be here. My name is Kathy Tenbrook. My preferred pronouns are she and hers. And I am the executive director of our state's Interagency Council on Homelessness. So just absolutely delighted to be here. My role today, I think, is to set a pretty high-level understanding of what homelessness looks like in the state of Minnesota. And I will leave it to these these incredible colleagues and partners around the state to talk more in-depth about youth homelessness and from their expert lenses. So I will go relatively quickly, but I do want you to know that my whole team is happy to meet with any of you if you have further questions or need to dive a little deeper into any piece of this information. So with that, I will get started here.
Sounds good.
Whoops, sorry. Let me go back one. There we go.
And members, as usual, the presentation's in your packet. You can follow along.
So if you're not familiar with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, this is a cabinet-level body. It is led by our lieutenant governor, and it is co-chaired by our housing commissioner and our human services commissioner, but it has the commissioners of all of these agencies that you see on the screen. It is a body that is intended to really drive policy and interagency budget decisions as it relates to housing stability and homelessness. And it was created with the understanding that no one of these agencies is responsible for preventing and ending homelessness, but homelessness has a lot of intersectionality. And so the importance of having all of these agencies engaged in this work in multiple ways, from preventing people from exiting public systems like into homelessness, like from corrections or the child welfare system, helping identify homelessness in highly mobile students across the state, addressing critical needs of domestic violence survivors, increasing incomes, supporting people in recovery, preventing overdoses, connecting to healthcare, or creating the kinds of housing opportunities that will work for all Minnesotans. So the role of the council is policy and budget decisions, but it also works to develop these very specific action plans that it does in partnership with all of our partners all across the state. And our last plan, called Heading Home Together, completed its work in 2020. And as you know, we got very, very busy during the last few years. Our office and our partners were deep in the work of protecting people experiencing homelessness during the pandemic. So we are now in the process of developing the next iteration of our strategic plan. And this is a plan that is focused on housing, health, and racial justice. So that will be a wonderful opportunity. I'd love to come back in the future with information from that plan. And that work is being co-led with all of us by 10 consultants with lived experience of homelessness. So to dive just a little bit into the data, this slide I know is very busy, and I apologize for that. I was trying to say a lot of things on one slide, but I'll do my best to unpack it just a little bit. So we have a few different ways of looking at data in Minnesota. We have this one-night point-in-time count, which is what you see on your screen here. This is a count done all across the country. It's required by the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level. Every community does this on one night in January every year. This is what we consider to be sort of a minimum count. It is simply an attempt to look at trend lines. We in no way think that this captures everybody experiencing homelessness, but it does give us a good idea of how we're doing overall on our progress. We have about 8,000 people in the last point in time count who are identified as experiencing homelessness all across the state. About a third of those were in greater Minnesota, and about two-thirds in the metro. It is a lot to look at on this slide, but I think if you draw your attention to the right-hand side, you can start to see by population how we're doing. Pretty flat overall since 2017 for the overall number of people experiencing homelessness. But we have had some progress, especially in the area of families with children. There have been very intentional investments made in this area, targeting the kinds of work that can keep families in their housing, and if families do become homeless, to try to quickly help identify children, especially in school districts across the state, and support them and their families in getting connected. While there's progress, you know, 4,957 people and families is still way too many people experiencing homelessness in the state of Minnesota, but it does show that the kinds of intentional investments and work has made a difference. You'll also see on this graph that unaccompanied youth numbers look like they're going down, and of course this is good news to us, but once again, I think of all the populations, I would say that homeless and highly mobile youth or homeless youth are by far the hardest to count through a point-in-time count type of survey.
I'm going to call on Representative Lee, who has a question.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burke, can you give us context comparing these Minnesota numbers and the trends to national trends? And then for the benefit of the committee, can you explain what chronic homelessness is?
Yeah, Commissioner.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for the question, Representative. I absolutely would love to do that. I don't know if I can tell you nationally how we compare right now. I didn't bring that data, but we do have a national study done by the National Alliance to End Homelessness that does have data of all states in the country. So I'd be happy to bring that to the committee if that makes sense, Chair Pinto.
If you could please, send that to us as follow-up, and we'll get that out to
absolutely
members.
Happy to do that. And the definition of chronic homelessness is somebody who has been homeless for a year or longer, or is repeatedly homeless, so four times over the course of the year. So some families and individuals who cycle in and out of our system would also be considered chronically homeless, as well as those who have been homeless for a very long period of time.
And Commissioner, maybe a very basic question. How are you defining homeless in this? Especially when I think about kids or families, what does that mean in this point of time in January of that year?
It sounds like it would be a simple question, but it is actually, there are multiple definitions of homelessness, just to make things even more complicated. For the point in time count, this is using the HUD definition of homelessness, which is somebody who lacks a fixed, regular, adequate place to live. It does not count, for example, people who are doubled up, however, whereas Minnesota's definition does. The education definition counts homeless and highly mobile students, so they can be doubled up. So unfortunately, it is a little hard sometimes to compare data sets because they're not really apples to apples, which makes it challenging.
And I guess just to follow up on that, so if I'm thinking about, this is January of 2022, you've got, 1,700 plus unaccompanied youth, 24 and under, et cetera. These are, and then families as well. You said no fixed adequate place to live, to stay.
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Helpful.
So there's a few other trend lines I'm here to share. One is that we have seen significant challenges, and I don't think this will be surprised to anybody in the committee, but a significant challenge in the number of people who are sleeping outside in the state of Minnesota. That number has gone up dramatically. While this is primarily adults, individual adults, they occasionally are children and youth represented in these numbers as well. So a very concerning part of our work, something that we are paying an enormous amount of attention to, and the governor and lieutenant governor's upcoming budget, and I know the work of this session will have a lot of intention on increasing the kinds of housing opportunities that will really work for people that are sleeping outside of Minnesota. It's also really important to note that the progress, and even these are just broad numbers, the progress even within these populations is different depending on where you live around the state. So it can be far more challenging in greater Minnesota, where transportation access is difficult, where distances between the kinds of services that are available are really hard to get to. And in tribal nations, some of the data for tribal nations isn't always well represented in our data sets. We do have, we're very fortunate in Minnesota to have the Wilder Research Center. They do a survey every 3 years. They weren't able to do it during COVID, but we'll do it this year again in October. And they also have a companion study they do in partnership with six tribal nations in northern Minnesota. And that gives us a lot of rich data. But for example, in youth homelessness, the numbers of youth on tribal nations, according to that data, is continuing to rise. So it, once again, just depends on where you are in the state, how these numbers look. And then I do want to say, because I know this is important to this committee as well, the other really important data that we have on people experiencing homelessness is through our homeless management information system. And that is more real time and more on a daily basis than many of our other pieces of data that we have. So very important not only to monitor and measure progress, but to always look at data to understand what to do better, what to do differently. I mentioned earlier that homelessness is a statewide issue. It absolutely occurs in all corners of our state, and I think student homelessness is one of the best examples of this. So all across the state of Minnesota, we have students who are experiencing homelessness, and they are in 1,000 schools in 289 school districts in 77 of our 87 counties that were identified. Once again, to your definition question, Chair Pinto, the definition of homeless and highly mobile students using the education definition is different. So this number of 7,235 includes students who are moving around a lot, who are doubled up as well. But obviously extremely concerning. We know that students who are experiencing homelessness lots of data has shown they do not do nearly as well in school. And I think a really important note is third grade reading levels for students who are experiencing homelessness are at rates less than half of the general population, and even substantially lower than students who are also living in poverty but are housed. So the fact of not having housing in and of itself seems to be a major factor in academic achievement.
I'm going to call on Representative Keith Spitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Tenbrook, I am curious, I mean, just kind of looking at the map here, so there's 10 counties where we don't have any students as a part of this data. And I'm curious, I mean, you know, we know that disproportionate numbers, as it lists here, students of color, American Indian students, LGBTQIA+, what is it, is this proportional? I mean, obviously, I can see some of the darker areas in the middle here, like near to some of our native lands, obviously in the metro, higher population in general. I'm curious, I mean, what does, at the county level, what does that look like in terms of proportion where we don't have any students as a part of that data?
Yeah, and I think, thank you. Thank you very much, Chair Pinto, and thank you for the question, Representative. I would say, even for the 10 counties that didn't identify homeless and highly mobile students who were enrolled on that date, I think it's hard to know for sure if that means there really weren't any or they, you know, were not able to be identified for whatever reason. So the limits of data. With that said, I would say, yes, the darker areas that you see on this map are where there's a higher concentration of students who were identified. as homeless and highly mobile. I feel like student homeless, child homelessness, youth homelessness both have some of the same challenges with counting, in part because, you know, homeless youth, for example, often don't really even consider themselves homeless. They may not self-identify as homeless. They may be living with, you know, doubled up or tripled up or sleeping on couches and just don't think of that or label that for themselves. So that may be also part of the challenge of that data. Yep.
Thank you. Continue, Commissioner, please.
So when we get into the reasons that people are experiencing homelessness, the very first thing I always want to mention is that I think the core of this issue is that homelessness really reflects these profound impacts of racism and inequity. So this chart in particular has always been really striking to me. It compares the general population, population of people living in poverty and people experiencing homelessness. So if you look at who is living in poverty, and that's that middle point here on this graph, you certainly see disparity. For example, there are four times more likely people to be living in poverty if you're American Indian than if you're a white Minnesotan, and you're three times more likely to be in poverty if you're black than a white Minnesotan. But when you go over to the right, you see just how dramatically different that is around homelessness. So 32 times more likely to be experiencing homelessness as an American Indian in Minnesota than a white Minnesotan, and 12 times more likely to be experiencing homelessness if you're black than if you're white. So deeply troubling, and certainly we know that as we work on our justice plan moving forward, we know that Minnesota clearly bears the ongoing injuries of this kind of racism. And so our work ahead will be to undo so many of those injustices in our next steps.
Commissioner, I'm a little bit worried about asking this question, maybe a little too big and broad, but can you briefly say what the mechanisms might be that cause homelessness in populations to be so much more than poverty? I'm sort of wondering about, like, access to support from family who themselves may be struggling with poverty. I don't know,
yeah.
Speculate, but could you just briefly about the mechanism between those two, because that is quite striking.
It is. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Yeah, I mean, I think historically our policies have been, you know, created redlining, discrimination in housing, intentional policies set the stage for this kind of disparity, and I think the ramifications of those still exist in communities all across state. So I think that's one piece of the answer. There's multiple answers. Certainly housing discrimination and all the things that we see, you know, prejudice, bias, those things show up in our systems. I think it's our job as a part of the work to undo those injustices is to look really closely at our own programs and efforts to make sure that they are not perpetuating the kinds of inequities and disparities and work to undo those. But there is a very big institutional systemic racism throughout our policies in this country that are impacting our housing system and poverty.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yep. Appreciate it. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Davis. I wasn't quite
Thank
sure.
You,
I saw you looking
Chair.
At me. Please, yeah, Representative
Thank
Davis.
You, Commissioner, could you just give us some examples of some policies that are racist? Thank you.
Throughout the course of history, I think the examples that come to mind the most, of course, are redlining and discrimination in housing. You know, those have impacted generations of communities and. Mm-hmm. The other piece of that I would say in terms of, for example, our Native American disparities is just histories of broken promises and loss of land and loss of wealth and opportunity. Those last for generations. So while we might not point to something today and say that policy that we have is racist on its face, the impact from generations of racist policies is showing up still today.
Yeah, follow-ups.
Just a quick follow-up. Are there any recent policies in recent years that have contributed to this?
I would say I'm certain. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think I'm certain that there are. I'm not going to sit here and try to name them for you, but I think what I would say is while some things may not feel overtly racist today, I think looking at them through the lens of are they actually undoing racism or are they perpetuating sort of status quo is maybe another way to think of that question. So while something might not be clearly overtly racist, is it actually doing what we need to do to undo the kinds of inequities that we see in our system? And that's a little bit of a different question than what you're asking, but I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
So we're going to go to Representative Katiza Watoon, then Representative Lesnikar. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm hopeful for the benefit of the committee. I mean, coming from a place of privilege as a middle-class white woman, I was not familiar with the process of redlining. So you've mentioned that a couple of times. We took action here in 2019. I believe Representative Jim Davney carried a policy change. And so for the benefit of our newer members who, you know, might be from out of state, just might not be familiar with that process, can you explain what redlining is and how it disproportionately impacts our residents of color?
Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Throughout in history, there was a moment in our history, and there's probably people in this room who could do this better than me, so I welcome them, where we actually quite literally drew lines for where people of color could live and where they couldn't. And that created pockets of wealth and opportunity and pockets where wealth and opportunity were not available. In addition to that, there were covenants put on homes and you know, people were quite literally not allowed to buy into certain homes and into certain neighborhoods because of those policies and practices. So what it ultimately did was just draw people out of opportunity and wealth building at the time, and therefore, once again, to the point, the generations of wealth that have been lost because of that.
Okay. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you. I have two questions. My first is, on the redlining, what years was this that you're referencing?
And Commissioner, do you happen to know when?
I don't know if I can recall exactly. Does anybody in the committee know?
Not
or anybody in the
so
room?
Much. Yeah, we may need to get back to you on that, Representative Lesnikar.
Yeah, happy to do that.
So, Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for your presentation. My second question is just in the essence of caring for people, person-centered care is a critical aspect that we talk about for all children, seniors. We talk about person-centered care and care plans. So is it possible that even when we have stable housing, that we have people at risk with stability factors? If the home is provided and the homeless piece is if every person was in a home, is it possible that we would still see stability factors if underlying things like mental health, addictions, criminal systems, all those pieces aren't addressed through person-centered care, case management? Wondered your feedback on that, because in caring for seniors, that's definitely, when we provide housing, we still have to deal with the underlying issues for successful outcomes to follow. For improvement for that person's life. So I'm curious on to your thoughts on that with children, and if the home is the only piece of providing that of that's going to lead to a positive educational outcome, and what role we're going to play. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Pinto, Representative, thank you for that question. It's a wonderful point, and it helps kind of set the stage, I think, for even more of what I wanted to talk about today, which is, to your point, it is often not just about the housing itself. It's about the kinds of supports and services and community and connection that people have in that housing that helps remain stably housed. So maybe the best way to answer your question, if it's okay with you and with you, Chair, is to keep going through the presentation, because I am going to get a little bit more into the kinds of person-centered and supportive services that people need, if that's okay with you.
We'll keep at that. And then,
okay.
Yeah, so Commissioner.
Great. So getting into it, we're really getting into some of the root causes of homelessness here, so I really appreciate this conversation. This one, the gap in the kinds of housing that people can afford is by far the biggest and perhaps most obvious driver of homelessness in our state. So the bottom line for people who are experiencing homelessness is that while there are complicating factors in many people's lives, the reason that people are experiencing homelessness is that they can't afford a place to live. Obviously, many people in our communities have complicating factors in their lives, substance use disorder, mental health issues, and, you know, complex health conditions, but are able to be housed because they have income, they may have supports in their life that allow that to be true. So the common denominator for people who are experiencing homelessness is that they don't have the ability to have that housing despite the systems in place. So this gap in housing is huge. This graph really shows it well. We have 177,000 almost renter households at or below 30% of area median income. And in our state, we only have 119,500 units that are at that price point that people could afford to live in them. And even among those, we have many people who make more than the income level for that price point that are taking up those units. So we just have, I mean, the bottom line of all of this data is there is a huge gap in the number of units that we need to have in our community to bring people home. Many people experiencing homelessness are working. The latest Wilder data that we have shows about 30% of homeless adults are employed at some level, and 13% full-time, but the level of income that people earn versus the cost of housing is just makes housing out of reach. And then getting into some of the other factors, one of the other reasons that we have seen for an increasing number of people sleeping outside in our communities is that in addition to our lack of housing, which is at the core, people do have increasing numbers of very complex health conditions that make their situations even more dire and more difficult in terms of finding, accessing, and stabilizing and keeping stable housing. And so this from the Wilder survey also shows sort of the various factors that are often in people's lives and the fact when they're co-occurring, how challenging that can be. Other factors that are also complex is that we do have people who have had some level of incarceration. So one in three women have had some connection to the justice system. Two in three men, and this is in the adult population, have had some connection. And that can often be the thing that prevents them from being able to access housing as well, having something on their record that gets in the way. When housing is really, really tight, the people least likely to get into that housing are people that have any kind of challenges with their record or their lack of rental history or their ability to pay the kinds of extra costs that it takes to get into the limited housing available. And then I do also want to mention that 37% of women who are experiencing homelessness have had some level of abuse. And so there is a lot in our work on the Interagency Council that is also focused on that intersectionality between domestic violence and homelessness as well. And so where I really want to go with this conversation too, and to leave you with when we're done, is that while this is all very challenging and is complex and does have a lot of intersectionality, ending homelessness is indeed possible. And I think it's important to know what we mean by ending homelessness too, because I think sometimes people are left with the impression that we're meaning that nobody ever again will have a housing crisis or have any challenges. That's not what we mean. We mean that if somebody does have a housing crisis, that we do everything we can to prevent that crisis from leading to homelessness, that we have systems in place to prevent eviction and support people to keep the housing that they have. And if somebody does become homeless, that we make sure that episode of homelessness is really brief. The longer a child is homeless, for example, the greater the trauma and the more difficulty there is for them going forward in their future. So quick identification, quickly identify what people need and get them connected to it. And then to the point on connection to services, making sure that people have not only the housing, but the kinds of services and supports that will work for them to keep them stably housed, whatever that means, whether it's connecting a family to the kinds of supports that their child needs for mental health services, or making sure that the family can increase their income through employment, training, and supports. Whatever it is that family or individual needs, keeping them in that housing is critical to ultimately end homelessness. The best example we have of this, I think, in Minnesota right now is our work on veteran homelessness. We have essentially created a system in 85 of our 87 counties that can do this for veterans. It can prevent them from becoming homeless, quickly identify them. We have a veteran registry where we know veterans literally by name. We know what they're eligible for. We know what they need. And then we connect them to the resources to end their homelessness and keep them stably housed through services at the Veterans Administration. So it can be done. It's a proof point. And we need essentially to create the same kinds of opportunities for families, children, and youth as well. Just a couple more slides if there's more questions, I'm also happy to take those. So I'm getting back to this housing stability continuum, and once again to the point of sometimes it's not just housing alone. This graph right up here really shows you the work that we focus on at the Interagency Council. The goal is to prevent and end homelessness, to create a healthy rental market for all low-income renters in Minnesota, and to close the disparities in homeownership. That's our continuum of housing goals. But we know in order to do that, we need to have the right amounts and strategic investments in each of these four big buckets you see on the screen. We clearly need to increase the amount of housing that we have, given the gap I just showed you. We also need to increase the amount of shelter that we have. There are some communities that have no access to emergency shelter in Minnesota. So it's very limited. And so we need to make sure we're increasing the amount of housing and shelter. We need to address the affordability, and that can be through increasing people's incomes. It can be through reducing the rates of rents, through rental assistance and other supports. We need to increase the accessibility of housing and shelter and make sure that there are no barriers for people getting into those. And then finally, ensure that we have adequate services and supports. And this is to the point, once again, that oftentimes, especially if you have complexity in your life, having supports to keep and remain, to keep stably housed is just as critical. I am excited to say, and I know some of you heard this yesterday, but the governor and lieutenant governor released their housing stability budget, over $1.6 billion across 9 agencies intended to focus on these very things, you know, preserve and produce housing, create the kinds of connections to supports and services, remove the barriers to access and increase affordability. So I'm really excited about that that work ahead. And so knowing that I'm probably a little bit over time, I will fly just and give you the contact information. This is our website. We have lots of information on this site, so feel free to come here. And then obviously any additional questions that we don't get to today, this is my contact information and the contact information for my team.
Commissioner, thank you so much. We'll see if there are questions for you from anybody. Representative Perez-Vega, we'll go with you, and then, yeah.
Thank you, Chairman Pinto. I don't have any questions, but I just want to highlight how important it is to educate the history of disinvestments in communities of color and the redlining. Minnesota is historically known for its racism in housing. There's documentations that have been led by legacy funds with Twin Cities Public Television and recent documents. And I come from a district specifically with the West Side Flats displacing the Mexican community and the Rondo community as well in the aftermath of 94 being built. So for other colleagues that are interested, I just want to say thank you for highlighting that and the importance of that and how we can be a better Minnesota where there's less homelessness around. Gracias.
Thank you. And if folks have not seen that piece by Twin Cities Public Television describing the history of that and showing it, it's really powerful. So thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. We'll go to Representative Zalesnikar. And then Representative Hudson, I think, is going to be after that. Okay, yep, Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Commissioner. My question is, this is such a serious issue, and I guess I would love your feedback on individuals' right to make decisions, even when they're perceived as poor decisions. And what systems exist in the state of Minnesota for adults who choose to refuse services? When I look at this, you know, 64% serious mental illness and 57% chronic physical health and 24% substance use disorder, those are specific needs. So what do we do to reduce the ER visits and assure that, you know, true success program happens? Do we have systems to identify this? And how is that balanced between good for the whole and individual rights? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Yep, thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair Pinto. So this is what I would say. There's a lot in that question that I'd like to speak to, but I think what I'll say is that, first of all, I want to be really, really clear. I've worked on homelessness for 30 years in direct service and then now at all levels of government. And I can very sincerely and honestly say that I have never once met somebody who is experiencing homelessness that wants to be experiencing homelessness or sort of quote unquote chooses to be. What is true is that we as a system and as a state don't always have the kinds of options that will work for them. So if somebody, for example, I'll use the most recent, the encampment that you probably heard about in Minneapolis, Cedar Riverside area. There were folks staying there for a long period of time, and working with Hennepin County, they literally had had a by-name list of who was there, what they wanted, what would work for them. Lots of people struggling with serious and persistent mental health issues, lots of people struggling with substance use disorder, but very consistently, people wanted housing. They were less interested in some of the shelter options that were available because they just didn't feel like they were what were going to meet their needs. They did want housing, but the kind of housing that will work for folks who are dealing with that kind of complexity in their life need to be created at a much higher scale than we have available. There are just too few of those. So it's housing that is obviously deeply affordable for somebody who has very, very little income. But then it's linked to the kinds of services and supports that people need to stay housed, you know, mental health supports, substance use disorder supports, and that's what keeps them out of the emergency room. You know, that's what keeps them out of encampments. That's what keeps them out of our other really costly public systems. And, you know, when I worked in direct service for years and years, lots of folks, you know, I worked with the police department in Minneapolis on a regular basis, and, you know, they would be so grateful when people would get connected to housing and supports, because that would be the very thing that would keep them from, you know, being something that the police department would try to have to deal with, when in fact that is not their area of expertise. And being homeless is not a crime. It's just they don't have anywhere else to go, and therefore that is a deep cost to local, you know, public safety providers that really shouldn't have to deal with that. What we need is the kinds of housing and supports that keeps people inside. And so, and it is true that people have choice. People must have choice. And so the kinds of things that we need to develop need to be things that they're choosing that work for them. And that is where we have seen the greatest success. You may have heard the words housing first used in the past. I don't know if that's a familiar term to you, but essentially what it means is that it works with people who are homeless, centers them in the decision making of what will work for them, gets them directly into housing and supports them there, as opposed to saying, well, we can get you into housing, but first you need to be sober, or you need to do this, or you need to jump through these hoops, and then we'll get you into housing. It kind of flips that on its head and says, actually, it's more cost effective, it's better for community, it's better for everybody if we get people the housing they're asking for and that they want first, and then surround them with the supports to keep them there. And it's a model that has proven that really there's really nobody that is sort of quote unquote not ready for housing. It's that our housing isn't ready for them, and so we need to shift that paradigm.
Thanks. We're going to keep on going with questions. I'll ask you, Commissioner, to try to keep your questions a little bit short if you can, and
okay.
not too much, but
yeah.
Just you know, keep an eye track on time. Representative Lesnikar, follow up from you.
Just, I guess, thank you, Commissioner. I have no doubt that everybody's going to choose housing. I guess my question is, if people refuse the services that allow for group living, then how do we assure that children and families and individuals that are co-living, coexisting together, aren't at risk when we have 64% mental illness and substance abuse if they're refusing treatment? And so the greater risk of that piece of denying, just refusing treatment on these identified risk factors that potentially is self-neglect, maybe by choice, or could put other people
from their perspective at, in harm's way, children and other situations. And because 30%, 7% of women have had some level of abuse, I'm just wanting to make sure that we have systems in place that's following people to help them have successful outcomes. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you. I don't know if I have much more to say.
Okay. Was there Representative Lesnikar, are you all done? Or you?
Yes.
Okay, good. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Tenbrook, I just want to take a moment to respond to a couple of times during the presentation and the commentary today. It's been suggested that Minnesota stands out as having a history of racism, and the implication being that we're a terrible state full of terrible people who've done terrible things. There may be some truth there, no doubt there is. But I just want to offer an alternative perspective that could perhaps leave us with a little bit more hope. My dad was a black kid who grew up in Detroit. He married a white woman. 10 years before their marriage, it would have been illegal for them to have that union in several states in this country. That is a very explicit racially discriminatory policy. In spite of that, one generation later, here I am. And as I look around this committee room, I see several examples of diversity. People who have been empowered, people who have been elected, people who are deciding public policy in this state. Minnesota is not a racist state. To the extent that racism occurs, to the extent that it is informing policies, we are rooting it out, and we certainly condemn it. When I moved to this state as a 12-year-old kid, my dad sought Minnesota because of the hope that it offered our family. He fulfilled not some grandiose American dream, but a meager one, a modest one, to have a better life for himself and his family and his children than the one that he had when he grew up. So I think when we look at the disparities in racial groups when it comes to homelessness and poverty, is it important to take a look back at the atrocious, explicitly, overtly racist policies that contributed to that? Absolutely. But I would caution us against putting too much weight on the generational impact, because it disempowers individuals to take responsibility for their circumstances, to overcome challenges, and to propel themselves into a better situation later in life. I appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
And that's all.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I'd like, Commissioner, give you the chance to comment. So one thing that I just want to say is I did not hear you as describing this as being a terrible state full of terrible people. I guess I definitely did hear you talking about terrible policies in the past, and also talking about, and this is, I guess, the thing I'd like you to comment on, where I definitely think I'd like to hear a little more from you on how those terrible policies in the past, in your view, have had an impact and are having an impact even today, because that feels like a sort of important point to join. But I just want to say, at least I was not hearing you describing this as a terrible state full of terrible people, but I definitely do hear you talking about racist policies having a big impact today. If you could just comment briefly on that,
yep.
Perhaps we'll be able to move on then. Commissioner.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative. Yes, you're absolutely right. I certainly didn't intend to imply that we're a terrible state. I love this state, and I think it's an amazing state. And the impact of racism on homelessness is just exceedingly clear to me after 30 years of doing this work. And so I think it's important to name it. I think it's important to look at the data. It's important to disaggregate the data. It's important to dive into the data and then really understand what it is we need to do to shift that going forward. How can we change the inequities and outcomes that people are achieving? And that's going to take a lot of really hard, dedicated, specific work. It doesn't mean that we're bad. It means that frankly, the changing face of leadership in this state is what gives me the greatest hope that that's possible. And so I'm really excited about the work ahead and doing that work. But, you know, investing in culturally specific community partners who can help serve people who feel disenfranchised in the way they've been served previously. I mean, there's so many things that we could talk about, but that's my hope, is that we dive into the data, we understand it, and then we can start to really address the root challenges that communities face.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Rev. Hudson, for your comments and to everybody. I think what I'd like to do is move on to our next presenter. Commissioner, thank you so much for the presentation and for your work. I know you've been at this for a really long time.
Yeah.
Terrific work. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We're going to bring up Dr. Jana Gerwitz-O'Brien, who's going to speak with us for just a few minutes, and then should be a nice transition into our the bill presentation. And, Doctor, hopefully you heard my comments before in terms of introducing yourself and preferred pronouns if you're comfortable, and then dive into your presentation. It may take you a minute, I guess, to get your presentation going here. Get some help.
Thank you. Let me check and see. Oh, yay. Here we are. Wonderful. So my name is Dr. Jana Gerwitz-O'Brien. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a pediatrician and an adolescent medicine physician. I work here in the Twin Cities, and then I'm also the medical director at the Bridge for Youth, which is a local youth shelter, and also provides transitional living and transitional housing program, which will be a part of the legislation that we'll be talking about today. I'm also on the executive board of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm the chapter's treasurer. So I'm also here representing pediatricians from across the state and thinking about child and family health. So I've been asked specifically to comment on the link between housing and health and think about the health needs of youth experiencing homelessness, which is where I spend a lot of my time. I'm at the Bridge for Youth 3 days a week, and certainly in my clinic at a large urban county medical center, I'm seeing young people who are struggling with housing instability and homelessness every single day. So we'll talk a little bit. We've heard some numbers so far, but I really want to spotlight the number of youth that are experiencing homelessness and housing instability throughout the state. In counts, we're finding somewhere over 13,000 youth, and this is very much an underestimate. I appreciate the questions earlier about what homelessness means and how that might look. So for the young people that I work with, this could look like running away from home. This could look like being thrown out of the home in the setting of abuse or rejection. This could look like what some people would call rough sleeping or sleeping on the street, sleeping outside, sleeping in encampments. It could also look like staying in shelter, where many youth land, and shelter is vital for youth. And it can also look like couch surfing. And when I use the term youth here, just to be in couch surfing and couch hopping, meaning staying with other people because they have no other place to stay that would be safer for me for them. And honestly, sometimes couch surfing itself can be pretty unsafe for young people's health. And just to be clear here, when I use the term youth, I'm referring to young people under the age of 24. And I'll primarily be focusing on youth who are on their own or youth who are pregnant and parenting who are out there on their own, meaning without another adult with them. These are not youth who are with parents. These are youth who are making it on their own and are remarkably resilient and savvy in the systems that they're in and who are very much doing it independently. Like, think about that. It's pretty impressive. Okay. So some of you may have heard this phrase before. It comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It says, health begins where we live, learn, work, and play. Let's think about that for a second, right? Health begins where we spend our time. This is not surprising. I don't think this is something I'll have to convince people of here. We know that the experience of not having a place to lay your head at night, the experiences of panicking because you're wondering where you or maybe you and your child are going to sleep, is very stressful and has implications for health. This is scary, right? Like, this is a hard experience.
They would call that the social determinants of health.
Yes, some call it the social determinants of health or the social drivers of health. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, homelessness and housing are one of those social drivers of health.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. I also want to point out, though, it's not only the experience of housing instability and homelessness that poses a threat to young people's health. So when we look at youth experiencing homelessness, we heard a bit about the disparities of the population of people experiencing homelessness in general. 73% identify as Black, Indigenous, or people of color. 23% identify as LGBTQ. This is not a surprise. We can talk about some of the policies that have led to this. We can also talk about ingrained oppression that occurs still day to day and that perpetrates homelessness. I also want to point this out, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is that young people who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and LGBTQ youth also experience health inequities at baseline. The experiences of homelessness compounds those health inequities. So we're seeing differences, and those differences are then compounded by not having a place to lay their head at night. So it's complicated. There are these intersecting identities and experiences that all kind of relate to health risk. I also want to specifically call out pregnant and parenting youth. And if you read my written testimony on this legislation, I also include a specific story from a young person who I worked with at the Bridge for Youth, who was staying in their transitional living program there. 1 in 3 young people in the state of Minnesota who are experiencing homelessness are pregnant or parenting. What I'm presenting here are national data looking at different age ranges and female-identifying versus male-identifying youth. Bottom line, pregnancy and parenthood is common. So when we're talking about youth experiencing homelessness, we're also talking about young families. And unfortunately, there are major gaps in care and housing services for pregnant and parenting youth in the state. And locally here in the Twin Cities and also in rural areas. Youth experiencing homelessness are also remarkably resilient in the face of trauma and adversity. So when we think about health risk, again, it's not just the risk of being out in the freezing cold in Minnesota or the risk of the experience of homelessness itself. It's also the risk of abuse and trauma and trafficking and exploitation that often occurs, unfortunately, at the hands of not only the people who are supposed to be there loving and caring for them, but also sometimes at the hands of systems that are meant to serve them. And that still occurs here in the state today, and it's a story I hear over and over again. I thought they were here to help me, and I was harmed by the very system that was here to help. So when we look at some of the numbers, nearly half of Minnesota youth have experienced some kind of physical abuse. More than 1/3 have experienced some kind of sexual abuse. 20 to 40%, this is national data, I didn't have time to grab my local data here, have experienced some form of trafficking and exploitation. So again, when we think about the risks of homelessness, we think about abuse and exploitation as kind of weighing into that too. This can occur before homelessness and actually can be a cause and driver of housing instability and homelessness. It can also occur during homelessness, when young people are out on the street and are facing, unfortunately, predatorial and very scary situations. And it can occur after, too, when they do return home or into different systems. When we think about the systems that serve youth, and specifically the systems that serve youth experiencing homelessness, housing is one part of the picture. We know that young people who've been in foster care and young people who've been in the justice system are overrepresented. I'd be missing the boat if we didn't talk about the intersections between these systems and if we didn't think about this from a cross-sector lens like we're hearing about earlier. Schools and healthcare are also places where young people are, where we need to be thinking about this. The legislation that was put forward and is going to be discussed a little bit later today addresses housing, which is instrumental and foundational. And also, if we don't think about all of these systems and bring them together, if we remain siloed, we have a big problem and we're missing the boat. So sometimes I'm asked, well, what are the health risks of homelessness? What does it mean? Like, what happens if a young person is homeless and what's the impact on their health? And it's more complicated than that. So I just want to bring this up. When I make this list, and I've also given talks on health risks associated with exploitation, health risks associated with incarceration, health risks associated with foster care, it's not surprising that this list is very similar. And absolutely, homelessness compounds those risks. Ultimately, what we're talking about are the risks of marginalization and oppression, the risks of not having a place to go because of some identities that you hold or an experience that you're sharing. And unfortunately, some of those historic systems of marginalization and oppression are still in place today and further compound the risk associated with homelessness. So I've included a list here, and we'll talk through some of the specific numbers. Trauma, violence, injury, and abuse are health risks associated with homelessness and marginalization and oppression. Sexual health risks like STIs and pregnancy are a big part of this, too. Chronic untreated medical conditions. I appreciated the comments about people struggling, and I think you're mainly talking about adults, but this is the case with youth too, chronic untreated medical conditions without that access to care is a big problem and something that affects young people. Mental health risk and suicide, we'll talk about those numbers. Substance use, we'll talk about those numbers. Again, I don't want to just think about substance use as a risk behavior or a personal choice. I want to think about it as a way that young people cope with significant trauma and adversity and something that happens that we see commonly when people are struggling. Barriers to care and then unmet basic needs. Not having enough food to eat, not having a place to stay can cause health risk. Minnesota's youth experiencing homelessness, this comes from Wilder Foundation that was mentioned earlier here in the state. 60% of young people reported serious mental illness. 33% of youth experienced physical health conditions. 16% met criteria for a substance use disorder. I want to point out that these are youth, right? So these are young people already experiencing this. We know that youth homelessness is a part of the pathway that leads to more chronic homelessness and that leads to more entrenchment. So I see an investment in youth as an investment in preventing some of the longer-term, more chronic homelessness later on. and preventing illness and improving health. We pulled this data from the Minnesota Student Survey, so these data are specifically from students reporting, so students in our schools across the state of Minnesota, and their health risk. Some of this relates to sexual health, looking at ever been or gotten someone pregnant before, looking at ever had sex. The light blue is stably housed, and I'm comparing them to young people who've run away at least once in the past 12 months in red, and young people who've experienced some form of homelessness in the prior 12 months in dark blue. And you can see here that as you think about each of these health risks that occur, it increases with running away to experiencing some form of homelessness. The one I want to point out here specifically that was really striking to me is this bottom number, which is the suicide attempt in the past 12 months. We're not talking about lifetime suicide attempt. We're not talking about just thinking about suicide. We're talking about I have tried to kill myself in the last year, and one in five young people who've experienced some form of homelessness have experienced that. Yes. I'll take a question. Hold on.
That's okay. No problem. Representative Katisa.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for this presentation. I have a question about this graph and kind of the bottom axis. Is this percent based, or is this like in thousands, or?
Oh, this was percent. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that.
Yes. I pulled this from the Minnesota State Adolescent Health Report as well, which we wrote these data for that a few years ago, highlighting youth who were incarcerated and then also thinking about youth experiencing homelessness. So for more information, I can share that afterward.
Doctor, please continue.
Absolutely. Thank you for your question. I also just want to point out that this is not a hopeless situation. This is a situation that I actually have a lot of hope for. I think when systems work together to address what's called protective factors, we use that in the research, when we think about how do we bolster resilience among young people, there is actually a lot of hope here. And I'm actually really excited because I think in Minnesota we do a lot of really great cutting-edge things that invest in young people, and I think we need more of them. So if you were to ask me, well, what would it take to improve health among youth experiencing homelessness? Housing would be first. We need housing, and we need shelter, and we need care. And absolutely, we need work to support family reunification. We know that family connections bolster resilience and protect against these health risks. We know connections with schools do something similar. When schools are well-resourced, when schools have healthcare centers on site, when they have mental health services on site, we made a historic investment in the state recently in the last 5 years about this. That can really bolster health risk and mental health among young people. Connections with community. I think this is a place where emergency shelter, and housing programs can really do. And then employment, identification, vital records, and then connections with healthcare and insurance. So again, we have a lot we can do here in the state. I'm really excited about the historic investment that's there, and I think we can do a lot to improve health among our youngest Minnesotans, children, and families. I'll pause there because I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Doctor. Yeah, this will be helpful to transition to our bill. So it looks like did a member have a question? Representative Nelson, I saw you. So yeah, please. Yeah.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Doctor. Kind of maybe a question. I don't know if maybe you're the correct person to answer, but youth, you know, I'm seeing up to 24, 25. I always kind of thought 18 is, you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, the closer I get to 50, the less youthful I feel. So, you know, maybe 25, I did feel rather youthful, but just kind of, you know, is there a, you know, what is the definition of youth, or, you know, how did it, you know, it,
so
I think a pediatrician is probably as good a person to ask as any. Yeah. Doctor, please.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm happy to share a little bit about this from a healthcare lens. So what we know that now about the developing adolescent brain is that the brain is still developing until around age 25 or 26. So if you were to ask me, what does the science say about how young people are developing? I think I would say early 20s, we know that brain is still there. And not surprisingly, it goes from the back of the brain to the front of the brain as we develop, meaning those decision-making skills, that higher-level executive functioning is still very much developing up until the early 20s. Likewise, we know that investments in early adulthood and also in minor-age youth, that's that under 18 range, are both really important, and that those young adults are often left out of the equation when it comes to services that exist. So from a healthcare perspective, we can talk about up until the early 20s, and I think that actually makes sense logically in terms of what we know about brain development. We also know that the brain is still very susceptible to things like addiction, to things like mental illness, early and to other environmental exposures and abuse up until early 20s, not surprising because the brain is still developing in that age range. From a definitions perspective, which I think we were getting into some of the challenges with definitions, and this also speaks to the cross-sector issues that our silos kind of all define this a little differently. different agencies define youth homelessness differently. And I will say that most of us who, or many of us who work with young people experiencing homelessness, will talk about youth and we will use a 24 or 25 and under lens. And then when you look at shelters, you'll sometimes see those that are devoted more to minor aged youth, like under 18, or young adults, 18 to 20. But I think when you hear the term youth, in my context at least, I can speak for, and in, I think some of the folks in this room, you'll hear people sometimes talk to up, about up to 24, 25.
I do want to move on to the bill if we can, but a quick follow-up, Representative Nelson.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. I know, like in Minnesota, you have, or maybe it's nationwide, we have education up to 21. You know, our high school education, I mean, that's allowable. I mean, most people graduate probably around 18, 19, somewhere in there. But I would just thank you for the explanation on that. And I think it just helps us understand you know, the difference between maybe, you know, the minor adults or the minor youth and versus, you know, young adults. And so thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Yeah, Doctor, thank you so much for the presentation. Really, really helpful. And thanks for your work for kids. Yeah. I'm going to have Vice Chair Keeler head on up. As I do, I'm going to note that we do have a quorum. We typically have in our committee have taken the role. But in this case, I missed that earlier in the interest of time, is Vice Chair Keeler's heading up. We'll just note that we have a quorum, so we'll be able to take action on the bill that's being presented. And I should note that this bill really is kind of, I hate to call a bill of this importance a cleanup item, but there was incredible work done in the last 2 years in the Preventing Homelessness Committee, with which Vice Chair Keeler was the vice chair of that committee. And so the bill, HF 444, comes out of that work, and so excited to do that. So Vice Chair Keeler, if you're upset, I think your motion is to have HF 444 re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and that is your motion, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and we do have an amendment, the A3, and so you're moving the A3, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and I think, I don't know if there's anything that we need to, any questions about the A3 amendment? And seeing none, then all in favor of approval of the author's amendment, the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So HF 444 is amended with the A3, and please present your bill, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair and members. One data point that I think is worth acknowledging is that for every move that a child makes, they miss almost 3 months of school academically. We talk a lot about what are we supposed to do to fix some of these systems. I think we can go back in the Rolodex of history and see all of these things. That's what I'm not here to do. I'm here to kind of share to you, over the last 2 years in the Minnesota House, we had a Preventing Homelessness Division. And extensively and emotionally, we sat through a lot of these conversations and listened to the communities come to us with solution-focused ideas. As it's been acknowledged, there are some of us who have broken, you know, glass ceilings to sit at this table. And with that, I come with a really deep life experience of what homelessness looks like, what abuse looks like, what suicide attempts look like. I know not only what it looks like, but I know what that feels like. And so I could sit here and talk a lot about how I think we got here, but instead I'm trying to form a solution on how we actually prevent homelessness moving forward. Taking into consideration, it's not just one thing that we have to do. And so what this is we've called it the Pathway Home Act, because I believe, and as I've said in many spaces with many of you, I think we all believe and we deeply understand that having a safe place to call home only excels us in so many other places in our life. We can look at the data, and you can see that people who look like me tend to show up in negative spaces or have higher rates of whatever it is, right? Health disparities, homelessness, abuse, neglect, attempt suicides, dropout in school, like the list goes on. But I really want us to enter into this space with an open mind and an open heart around a solution on how we protect our next generations moving forward. So I'm going to walk through the bill with you in what I feel like is really well vetted, in the sense that we had these conversations for 2 years. Chair Gomez did an amazing job bringing people into the space. Molly Peterson and Sean Herring did an amazing job staffing this and continuing to help me move this forward into this lens, into this committee. So I'll walk through the bill with you, and then I'll yield the rest of my time to some of our testifiers as they can tell the better story. But the first part of this is around shelter capital. We know that shelter saves lives. It gets people off the streets. We live in Minnesota, y'all. Like, can't tell me that we would survive some of these winters. And so What this does is it actually looks at an assessment that was done statewide as a Greater Minnesota member. You know, it's always important to me that we're not just funneling money into the cities, but one of the elements is that is at least 40% of this money would have to go to Greater Minnesota. That's a lot of our communities, because what we know is that if we don't have the resources in our community, they just funnel down the road and they move further away from their community, which is where actually those best supports are. So we can give them housing, we can give them shelter, but what do we do once we have that? And so that's where the ESP program is in. And this is what helps operate the ongoing programs, the staffing, the things that we need to partner with individuals so they learn maybe some of those skills that they aren't super keen on or they need a little bit of help with. The other part of it is transitional housing. So once we've gotten you off the street, we saved your life on that night, we're giving you resources, there's an opportunity for transitional housing. This is how we get people who maybe historically haven't had opportunities to own home, or they don't have generations before them to teach you the path to that. This is an opportunity to really help and guide people with supportive services for an amount of time of up to 36 months, which we believe is a significant investment in helping people learn how to be homeowners and stay consistent in that space. The Youth Homeless Act, we've heard it here, right? It is extremely important that we invest in that. What this did, it actually took the voices of the kids on the streets. You want to know how to fix homelessness. Ask the people who have experienced homelessness. That's what we've done. This is investing into that program for community outreach, drop-in programs. They're doing street outreach. That's a big deal. To know where your kids are at and to build those relationships is amazing. And so that's funding for that. And then underneath that, kind of back to your question, Representative Nelson, that young adult group, you know, like, and we know also nobody said that here, but boys' frontal lobes develop a little bit slower than girls. So we'll give you guys the benefit of the doubt that we also need a little bit of help in that early adult, that if you didn't have the capacity in your young adult, that, you know, once you're out in the world right away, if we're not giving you some tools to partner with maybe some people in your community, it's a pilot program. After a year, we'll look at what they're doing, we'll assess and see how that's working, but I think it's worth taking an investment or an opportunity in. And lastly, it's the HMIS system that brings all of this together. If we don't know what services we're doing, we don't know how they work, we don't know how to access them, and we can't quickly move our population to the spaces that actually have space. I mean, it used to be a system where you would just take a guess. Let me go stand in a line all day and hope that they have a bed. This system is designed for us to be more efficient and effective in how we're supporting our communities, but also collecting the data so that collectively we know what we need to do to continue to move forward to prevent homelessness. That's what this bill is in a package. Again, it is the Pathway Home Act, knowing that this is only the start of a pathway that hopefully, as you all move bills through all of your committee, all of us have a role to play in preventing homelessness. It's about opportunity. It's about encouragement. It's about letting people know that we have your back when times get tough. This isn't a handout. This is absolutely a hand up for our future. So with that, Chair, I'll yield to the rest of my testifiers for the time. Pilamaya, thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Keeler. Yeah, and I should have, yeah, as our first testifier comes up, I've been calling the bill by its bill number, but yes, it's more properly referred to by its name, Pathway Home. Yeah, please take a seat. The Pathway Home Act, because that's exactly what the work that you all have done, what you've done, Representative Keeler, to put this together. So welcome. So glad to have you here, Beth Hoger. And so please introduce yourself, identify yourself, and proceed. And I should note for you and the other testifiers, I ask you to stick to just 3 minutes, if you can, apiece, to make sure that we have time to vote the bill out before 10. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, members of the committee. I have to just first start by saying an incredible thank you to Representative Keeler for her sacrifice and her leadership and everything she's doing for so many good things. I have so much respect for you. I also want to thank Commissioner Tenbrook. Cannot thank you enough for your sacrifice and leadership and your presentation today. Thank you.
And if you can lean in a little bit to the mic, or adjust the mic just to make sure we're hearing
you. I'm kind of tall. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. My name is Beth Holger. I serve as the CEO of The Link. The Link is a nonprofit that provides a continuum of street outreach services, emergency shelter, and housing for youth and young families who are experiencing homelessness, have been victims of sex trafficking, or who are involved in the foster care or juvenile justice system. I'm here today also as a co-chair for the policy committee of the YSN. The YSN stands for the Youth Services Network, which is a coalition of all of us, because the link definitely does not do this work alone, of agencies across the state providing support, the critical needed shelter and housing for youth experiencing homelessness. So very thankful for all those partners. I'm here today to testify in strong support of House File 444. We need every single thing that Representative Keeler just outlined. It's a matter of life and truly death in many cases. Youth homelessness is a very real crisis in our state. On any given night, we have 4,872 unaccompanied youth experiencing homelessness and only 312 emergency shelter beds. We see youth that are sleeping in the entryway of doorways without shoes. We see youth that are trading sex for a couch to sleep on. We see youth that are sleeping in a car, a broken down car most of the time, in a Walmart parking lot in Apple Valley, and we see youth living in encampments. We're seeing increased levels of mental health crises, of domestic violence, and the impacts of gun violence. And just really quickly, I'll give you two brief examples. One is that we had a young mother, identifies as Black, is coming home with her baby and her child's father and boyfriend. As they're coming into their park in the parking lot of their apartment where they pay rent and to a landlord, the boyfriend is unfortunately gunned down right in front of the mother, his girlfriend, and their baby. The landlord, instead of saying, oh my gosh, this horrible thing just happened to you, decides to evict them because the other tenants in the building are now afraid. So that young person became homeless because she came from a background of poverty. She had been working really hard to lift herself and her child out of that, as well as the father, but because they didn't have a support network, ended up becoming homeless and are now in our housing program, obviously in a different building. We also have worked with so many young people, but another key example is a young person who got into an argument with his older brother. And this young person happened to identify as gay. When he got into the argument with his older brother outed him to their mom, who is extremely homophobic. She then started to physically beat him inside of the house. He ran outside of the house, was running down the sidewalk. Mom gets in her car, starts driving after him on the sidewalk. So he came into our culturally specific housing for LGBTQ young people experiencing homelessness. So these are very real things that are happening all the time. Not just the day, the night, et cetera. And I know I have briefs, so I will be brief, but want to let you know how real this is. And also, this absolutely is a solvable issue. We know the numbers. We have all the data. We know the numbers of young people. We know what it's going to take, and that is the Homeless Youth Act, increased investments. Last time we had an increased investment of $3 million back in 2015, during the same time period, we saw a decrease from 6,000 homeless youth a night to 4,872. So we're making incredible progress, and I'm very thankful for the legislature for that investment. But we need to do more of it, and it's an opportunity, and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Holger. And I should note, I've had the chance to work with Ms. Holger for many years, work against exploitation trafficking, and you do incredible work. Thank you so much for all of it.
Thank you, Chair and members and Representative Keeler.
Thank you. Good. And so we have Catherine Mierce, I think, is going to be substituting for our next testifier. And so come on up, and if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Pinto, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 444, and also thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, so much for leading this effort. I apologize for the fact that our young mom was not able to join to speak to you all this morning. As you can imagine, 8:30 in the morning is a little bit of a tough time for a young parent. So I am here to step in. My name is Catherine Mierce. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the Executive Director for Avenues for Youth. We support youth experiencing homelessness with shelters in Minneapolis and Brooklyn Park and with a variety of community-based programs. My colleagues have explained the youth homelessness crisis very well, so I will be very brief and just share two youth stories with you. Youth experiencing homelessness have distinct needs that are different from those of single adults or families. When providing developmentally appropriate supports, youth can successfully move into stable housing and thrive as young adults. One young person that I want to tell you about is Shantasia. Shantasia came to Avenues after living in an abandoned house and couch hopping. She felt depressed, angry, and suicidal. Over time, she opened up to staff about her dream to become a nurse and took full advantage of the education and employment resources, as well as the mental health resources that Avenues offers on site. While living at Avenues, she shared with the staff that she had a dream. Her dream was to become a nurse. While she was with us, she became a certified nursing assistant. She has now moved into her own apartment and is pursuing a career as a registered nurse. I love sharing success stories like this because I really think it's important to understand that if we intervene early with young people experiencing homelessness, they are able to become thriving young adults. I also want to share a story about a young mom. I'm going to call her Dominique. Dominique was living in her car with her one-year-old baby because she was fleeing a domestic violence situation, and she was afraid to go to the shelters because she knew her partner would look for her there. She was referred to our rapid rehousing program. That is a program where we help a young person find an apartment, and then we're able to provide rental subsidies while we're providing case management for them to be able to take over that rent. As other speakers have noted, the availability of affordable apartments is extremely limited. But our program manager, Carissa Coley, did heroic work in finding this young person an apartment within 5 days of being referred. It should not take heroic work for us to house a young person living in her car fleeing a domestic violence situation. House File 444 is an important step in providing for safe and accessible shelters and supports for youth like Shantasia and Dominique. Thank you again for this opportunity to support this crucial investment.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your work, your testimony, and your work. So, and finally, we have Jacqueline White and Brenda Pritchard, who I think are coming up together, I believe. And so you can please maybe grab your extra chair up there and identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, committee members. My name is Jacqueline White. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the founder and executive director of Close Knit. We are loving youth out of homelessness. I am here to speak specifically on subdivision 4 of House File 444, which is about supporting chosen family hosting. We need to understand that youth homelessness is a population level crisis. 1 in 10 young adults will face homelessness over the course of a year. Currently, as Beth shared earlier, we have a severe shortage of beds that we can provide. Currently, we can provide 6.5% of the youth who need housing a place to stay every night. So we really need to think at scale, right? How do we really address this population level crisis? When we think at scale, who is the largest provider of affordable housing? It's family. When we think about young adults today who aren't homeless, the majority of them, 60%, are actually staying with their parents. But what about young adults who are who can't go home, right? If you can't go and stay with your parents, which is the normative thing that young people are doing now, where do you stay? Young people end up staying with chosen family. They stay with their neighbor. They stay with their best friend's mom. They stay with their cousin. Representative Pinto, to speak to your point, that a lot of times the people who the young people end up staying with are themselves stressed, right? And again, when we're talking about, 3/4 of youth facing homelessness in Minnesota are Black, Indigenous, or people of color, the people who they generally stay with also are. And when we look at, we've been having a really robust discussion about the racial implications of homelessness, and one of the big factors that ends up, that we see is that there's a really big difference between stabilizing chosen family arrangement when the host is a homeowner as compared to a renter. And we know that there are huge disparities. The majority of BIPOC households in Minnesota are renters, and the majority of white households are homeowners. So this provision, the chosen family, is really looking at how do we stabilize these chosen family arrangements. And the person
who... And we'll have you wrap up now. We're at the three-minute mark, so but thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate the testimony, though.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Yeah, the three-minute mark. But thank you. I think we had 3 minutes for the two of you together was my understanding. Yeah, so my apologies if there's misunderstanding there. Is there anybody else in the public who wishes to testify? Okay, so we can open up for questions from the question or comments from the committee. Representative Gutierrez-Ortoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, for bringing this bill forward. I know the amount of work that you've done on this over the past few years, and I just really appreciate it. I also know a little bit more than maybe some of the members about, you know, your personal experience and where you come from and the heart of gold that you have and the difference that you are making, not only as a representative of the state of Minnesota, but in your local community. I want to say that none of us want to be in this situation. I really wish we didn't have to make this sort of investment. I wish that children and families weren't in these situations. But we can't wish or hope or pray ourselves out of this crisis. And it's us together here who can make the difference, not only for today, but for all of the tomorrows for the children and families of Minnesota. And it's sometimes in other conversations we talk about adoption and how that is the solution to other challenges that Minnesotans face. I want to voice support specifically for the chosen family section of the bill, because as a former foster and adoptive parent, and I know a number of us on this side of the aisle, and maybe some of the folks on the other side of the aisle have been foster parents or are adoptive parents, but we know that, you know, adoption isn't the only solution for Minnesotans, particularly for those youth in foster care. And so I think that it's critical that piece be included. I just brought up the MinAdopt website, and there are 130 children right now in the foster care system whose parental rights have already been terminated. 77 of them are 15 or above. And so, you know, those kids have a few years to find a family, a permanent loving family, a safe place to be before they, you know, turn 18, they age out of the system, and then they don't have anywhere to go for Christmas. They don't have anywhere to go when life's challenges pop up. And I think that in the shaping of this bill, in the public testimony that you've taken and working with these community groups, you've really thought through all of these pieces and put together such an amazing piece of legislation. So thank you for that. And to those people watching, I really do want to ask that you open your heart to foster care, because there are children waiting, and every child in Minnesota, every person in Minnesota deserves a loving and safe place to call home, and we can be a big part of that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gutierrez-Ortoon. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Hi. Thank you so much, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward. You know, I'm in the suburbs, so I kind of dug in a little bit into this when it comes to Washington County. Washington County is the fifth largest county population-wise in the state. We go all the way up from Forest Lake all the way down to Cottage Grove, so a very narrow but large county along the river. And Woodbury is the eighth largest city in the state. We're about almost 75,000 people. We have no county-run homeless shelters. There are two that are volunteer or community-based, one in Hugo, one in Oakdale. They have a maximum capacity of serving 10 families. As I dug a little deeper, I found that there are about 358 students experiencing homelessness, which I grew up in rural Minnesota, that's four times my graduating class. So So this bill would have a significant impact in my county and my district with the emergency services grant to help with plans for establishing those housing where we currently have none. And it would have a significant impact in the appropriation for the county to have the capital to modify and provide dignified and culturally appropriate space. Because right now, well, all of Woodbury has is interim hotel space for maybe about 20 people. Yeah. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, for bringing this bill forward. Like my counterpart here, I live in a community that has very little homeless housing available for our community. I actually live right in a neighborhood that's surrounded by the hotels that our county uses to provide hotel vouchers to. So every day I see firsthand families and children who are facing just dire situations, in addition to living in one of the poorest precincts in my community. And so I'm really grateful for this, and I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward. I know the Committee on Preventing Homelessness put in so many hours, and we've heard the stories about the testifiers that came forward to share their story, and so to them I also say thank you, and hopefully this is the culmination of their work and the value of stepping forward to share your stories. You know, as somebody who, as a mom and as a person who's experienced intermittent housing instability, as a family to the youth who can't go home, and just as a Minnesotan and a human, I just can't say thank you enough for bringing this forward and continuing to do this work. We need this kind of systemic investment in our kids and families and fellow Minnesotans, because struggling and battling disease and illness and poverty and discrimination isn't okay. And we have what it takes to do better, and I'm looking forward to doing that. Thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to, be conscious of our time here, so I'll be brief. But I also want to join the chorus in thanking Representative Keeler and everybody who has done the work on this bill. And I'm going to go ahead and suggest that my district, being where it is, has probably more hotel rooms than any other host district in the state. So we well know the impact of seeing how counties and nonprofits have had to contract with hotels to address these issues. And, you know, in my former life as a city council member, I was hearing about these issues quite a bit during the pandemic from constituents. And the truth is that this was a crisis before the pandemic, and it became increasingly acute during the pandemic because of systemic underinvestment in exactly what this bill is investing in now. And I know that shows up in our communities in a lot of different ways. And so thinking about the number of interactions that folks have with public safety in the correction system and various other systems that we know will be bettered by these investments and by the work that Representative Keeler and others have done, it's going to make a big difference for a lot of folks in Minnesota. And I'm just really, really grateful to support this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Mm-hmm. And so Representative, I'm sorry, who is it? Representative Perez-Vega.
Just really brief. Thank you, Chairman. Representative Keeler, thank you. This work is so important and needed. As a youth worker who's worked throughout this entire state, from right here in this district, we can see the homelessness. We can see the youth. And if you don't, they're my students. Mm-hmm. And they go home without a home and hungry. And they come from not just St. Paul. They come from Red Lake. They come from Bemidji. They come from Rochester. And this is an opportunity of hope from them through all of your dedication and everyone who's worked on this. So muchas gracias. You're giving our kids hope in this state.
Thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. Final comments from any members here, questions at all? Lee Daniels, you've possibly something? Yeah, Lee Daniels, please, and then we'll go to the Vice Chair Keeler.
Lee Daniels. Thank you, Chair Pinto. I like the intent of this. I mean, I'm a second-generation foster care parent. My daughter is a third-generation foster parent, so we know the struggles that go through. But I have a couple concerns with the bill. I know in DHS in 2021, they had $22 million they were given to help with child care, and there was about 7 or 8 month delay getting the funds out. So I'm just curious, is there anything built in to get these funds out quicker? Because this is a lot more money than $22 million. If anybody from DHS can, that's, and they can do it offline, but I just, just that's a concern.
And just maybe just to pause on that, I will add, it may be just briefly, Representative Keeler could respond to that, because we certainly want to get funds out to families as quickly as possible. It wouldn't want a delay. Looks like Representative Keeler had something briefly you want to say on that?
Yeah, that's, yeah, the ESP program is a quick turnaround. We took that into consideration, knowing that when we have concerns, waiting 7 months doesn't actually fix the concern. So I can get the specific time frame turnaround, but, I mean, it's weeks. It's still leaving a space that we're diligent in doing review, but it's much quicker than some of those RFP long grant programs. We can get you the specifics.
Okay, good. Thank you, Representative Keeler. And so, and please continue to lead Daniels, but absolutely, that's a great point. We want to make sure funds get out as quickly as possible.
And then another question I have is, we talked about Greater Minnesota, not only the metro, but Greater Minnesota. Is there anything designed to where this money will be funneled as far as for the ratio of metro to Greater Minnesota? I know in the Transportation Committee it's usually 60-40. Is there anything in the bill that would actually cover that?
And I think that's good to have our one of our Greater Minnesota and the members in a lead briefly respond to that. Representative Keeler?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Lead Daniels. I mean, we did allocate 40% to Greater Minnesota, saying that if they didn't spend that 40%, it will cancel back to then the rest of Minnesota projects. But it is a dedicated, like I mentioned when I opened, Greater Minnesota is absolutely a priority for me. So we did do the 40-60 split. That was the last amendment, so the most current engrossment has that in language already.
And I think, Lee Daniels, if a lot of this money does not go to Greater Minnesota, I think Representative Keeler is going to be the first person going after pretty hard, I can assure you. Lee Daniels, please.
Well, I've got some other concerns, but I know we're running short of time. I just appreciate the conversation, and I know it's a concern. I'm not exactly sure how this kind of money is going to take people that would help them transition into homes, but we'll see how that plays out. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And so final comments, Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair, and Lead Daniels. I have to say I'm passionately invested in this work, so I am open to further conversations and ideas and solutions. I've said that to other people on your side. I want to solve this. I want to work some of these wonderful people out of their jobs, if that's a possibility. But so as far as the money and as far as the investment, I know that it's a lot to ask. But if we don't address homelessness, it's going to show up in other spaces. So we had a doctor come in and talk about the economic impact. And I just want to go back real quickly to go through the math on this and why I think the investment is actually important. Per the time and count, or the point in time count that was in January, which January 25th is the next one. So if people know where to find their people, we can have the best number. But that was 7,917 people. Dr. Foldis did a cohort of 1,451 unaccompanied youth to figure out what the cost was on taxpayers. Interesting enough, over a year, it cost $30 million, which breaks down to roughly $20,000 per person. So if we take the 20,000 times the number that we get, which we know is the floor of the number, there's more people, but this is just a baseline like we heard, that investment is actually pretty significant. It's $150 million. And so if you look at what we're doing, I believe that if we invest in a path that actually has proven data to show it helps people get out of homelessness rather than sending them to an average night in an ER is $1,462, an average night of incarceration is $200. So I think if we just switch the investment and put it into the investment and use the money in patterns and habits that we know work, it's better than just continuously letting them fall through cracks. So I've thought about it. That's why the dollar amount is there. It's just offsetting the cost that we're already putting into this problem and have a better hopeful solution with it. But always open for further conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, speaking of a better hopeful solution, Representative Keeler renews her motion that House File 444, as amended, the Pathway Home Act, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And with that, the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. This is a wonderful, wonderful proposal, and so excited for it. Thank you so much, Representative Keeler, for your work and to everybody who put work into it. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you so much. Apologies for going over a few minutes.